Hey, what's going on? It's At the Letters for Thursday, July 30th / Friday, July 31st. I'm going to explain that to you in a second. My name's Arden Zwelling. I'm joined as always by my colleague Ben Nicholson-Smith from Sportsnet.ca. Christian Ryan is our producer. You can follow him on Twitter at @ChristianRyanNS. He's had his work cut out for him this week. Let me tell you why. If you have been following MLB at all, over the last few days of this final week of July, you have perhaps noticed that it is complete chaos with COVID. And that is what this virus does. It does not have a schedule. It does not care when your games are scheduled. It doesn't care when your teams are practicing. It doesn't care how many protocols that you put in place and how closely you followed them. All it cares about is moving between human and human via airborne droplets. And that is something that has been happening quite a bit across MLB. So we actually attempted to record this podcast on Thursday, the 30th, and the back half of it is all going to be from Thursday and from the reality that Ben and I were existing in on Thursday. But the news is just moving so fast that we had to drop back in here on Friday morning just to talk about what is going on in MLB with the COVID outbreak in Miami, which has now, or with the Marlins, I should say, in Philadelphia, which has now cascaded down to, by my count, like 8 teams. It is Friday, July 31st. It is 10:11 a.m. in the morning. And what we currently know is that the Marlins have not played for a week. They will not play until next week at the earliest. Same for the Phillies. Haven't played this week. They won't play until next week at the earliest. The Blue Jays weekend games have been postponed. The Yankees have missed games. The Orioles have missed games. The Nationals, the Cardinals, the Brewers, I'm probably forgetting a team in there somewhere, but Ben, we're talking about upwards of 20% of the league, probably even more now. And this is a story that is still very much developing. So even though we have now dropped back in to re-record and to like update this with the latest information that we have available to ourselves right now, by the time anyone listens to this, I mean, who knows, there might not be baseball at all.
What a week, right? Like it is such a varied week. In the one hand, it's so nice to have baseball back. It's actually been so fun watching the games. And this is our first podcast that we've recorded with actual games to discuss since, I'm going to say, like October of last year, you know, like September, October of last year. So it's so refreshing on the one hand to have these games and to have these performances to discuss. And we will get to some of those. But man, like you can't even begin to discuss those games until you've acknowledged the reality that Major League Baseball is trying to operate in and trying and failing in a lot of cases to operate in. And that is one of, you know, basically making it up on the fly in this COVID-19 world. It's obviously a frustrating time, a scary time for a lot of those teams and players and people who are testing positive. That is, this virus is very deadly in some cases. So it is very much a scary time. But for the league, this is a situation that they don't appear to have answers for, but they also don't appear to be slowing down.
They don't have a handle on this thing at all. Just like things have gone in the United States since this became a thing in our lives, since we all became aware of what COVID-19 is and we all learned terms like social distancing and, you know, flattening the curve and all these things are just like second nature to us now, which none of us said ever in our lives in February. Ever since we learned this stuff, I mean, the United States has just done such an abjectly embarrassing job of mitigating the virus, of containing it, of leading at this point, and just like go on the internet and find a million graphs to support what I just said and a million charts that will show you which countries have handled this well and which have not. And the really disillusioning thing is that for us in North America, like we actually got this later than countries in Asia did, than Europe did. We should have been better prepared and we should have known better how to handle this and what was going to be possible for us going forward, because we watched other countries go through it first and the US still like just completely screwed this up. And I think that MLB is looking at the leadership in the United States and is looking at the political climate there and saying, well, Americans are so desensitized to the amount of cases every single day, to the amount of deaths every single day, that sure, we can just keep playing. We can just keep this thing going and keep rolling ahead. There's no opposition to that. Tony Fauci threw out the first pitch of the season. That is the guy on the Trump administration's response to this. Like, that is the guy who is informing these decisions that American leadership is making. He showed up and threw the first pitch of your season. That is as much of an endorsement of what you are doing as I can imagine. But I don't know where you could find an epidemiologist or an infectious disease expert who will tell you, outside of Tony Fauci, I guess, that this is a good idea to continue, that MLB should just like roll forward with a massive outbreak in the Marlins clubhouse, with positive tests on other teams now, with a clubhouse attendant in Philadelphia who got it, which, like, to me was the ultimate nightmare scenario. You know, like Rob Manfred was asked on MLB Network, like, is this your nightmare scenario that the Marlins had an outbreak? And he said, no. To me, the nightmare scenario was that somebody in the orbit of this game who is obligated to work at these stadiums and to show up and just do their job, somebody who's not a professional athlete and doesn't have the same means and the same privileges and perks that pro athletes do, somebody like that was going to get it. And I know I've said that on this podcast and on like a million Sportsnet platforms. And here we are. Somebody did get it. A clubhouse attendant got it. And we don't know if that individual took it back to their community, if they went back to their families. We don't know if they were on public transportation. We don't know if they went to the market. Like, we don't know. And we won't know. We'll never know that individual's name. We'll probably never hear about them again. And so to me, the fact that, you know, that is happening now, like, MLB is contributing to the spread of the virus, in my opinion. And I am just like completely disillusioned by the fact that this is even continuing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's objectively true that MLB is contributing to the spread of the virus. It's hard to deny that that's the reality when you're crisscrossing the country and you're basically going from city to city, exposing your players and staff to all sorts of different environments in pretty short order. Those are the very behaviors that will lead to the spread of COVID-19, without a doubt. So you can see why the Canadian federal government decided that they did not want these major league teams going in and out of Toronto. And at this point, that looks like a good decision. It looks like that was the prudent decision when you look at the amount of risk that these teams are now bringing into the cities that they visit. And it is such a contrast between what we saw in training camp, where, you know, in a sense, you can kind of get lulled into this false sense of security when teams are all in one place. And in the Blue Jays case, that was here in Toronto. Other teams were training at their respective home ballparks. And basically, those teams would be isolated from one another and, relatively speaking, isolated from the world at large. But now you introduce travel. Now you put these teams in contact with each other, and we're seeing that this can all shift very quickly, especially at a time that there doesn't seem to be full buy-in from players when it comes to spitting, when it comes to fist bumping, handshaking. Like, I know there's muscle memory involved here, but that's something that all of us have had to get used to. I mean, I've seen people that I know, and in the last few months, I don't reach out to shake their hand anymore. That's muscle memory, but, you know, you kind of make those adjustments. I think Major League Baseball, you know, big picture, there are decisions, as you said, Arden, with the U.S. government. And then slightly bigger picture, you have Major League Baseball, and are they going to pull the plug? I don't think that's happening soon. But even on a more granular, like, team level, I think that we could see players and coaches do a better job of those little things that do add up and do play a role potentially in spreading the virus.
I had like the most humiliating thing happen to me like a couple months ago, where I met a new neighbor in my neighborhood and I just like immediately reached out my hand to shake their hand, right? Yeah. And I just, which speaks to that muscle memory, right? And I like looked at them like, why aren't you shaking my hand? And then I was like, oh my, I am so sorry. Yeah. And I was like, I was humiliated, right? Like, I was embarrassed and I felt great shame for that. So that muscle memory like is clearly still there. So I understand if a player like spits, because that's just what they've done throughout their entire baseball lives. But I do not understand why they wouldn't correct that behavior after it happens. Because I watch these games and you're right, like, spitting galore. Guys have sunflower seeds. They're not supposed to. We're seeing high fives, celebrations. There's no mask wearing occurring. Some guys are wearing masks there below their noses. I mean, like, it's just like, of course,
it's a chin strap.
This is happening, man. Right? If you wear the mask below your nose, you might as well wear it around your wrist. Like, what are you doing? So, of course, this is happening. And, like, what is happening in MLB right now is proof that their protocols are not effective. We've seen the operations manual. This is a 100-plus page document with all these guidelines and all these protocols in it. Well, you've got an outbreak in MLB right now. This is proof that what you are doing is not effective. And like, you can blame Marlins players for who may or may not have gone out like on the town in, I think it was in Atlanta or wherever they were. Like, I don't know. We have no idea like what's true and what's not. And just like how seriously they took this and how seriously they did not. But through the protocols, I mean, they were still in hotels where there were other members of the public congregating. You know, through the protocols, they are traveling between airports, between hotspots in the United States, from city to city. I mean, this plan, you know, you didn't have to look far before MLB even started to find an infectious disease expert who was like scratching their head, like, sorry, you want to do what? Like, you really think this is going to work? And those individuals have been proven right. And we are seeing now, like, MLB is trying to tighten the protocols, which is in itself an admission that your original protocols were not effective, because now you are saying, okay, now we're going to have like a, you know, this cop that is with the team that is going to have to, you know, police all of this stuff. And like, now we're really going to, you know, crack down on these things and those things. And, you know, we're going to say that you can't leave the hotel. And like, well, there's just no second chances with this, man. Like, people are getting sick. People are getting the virus. Like, we don't know what kind of impacts this is going to have on players' lives, on their families' lives, on the individuals that they congregate with in their communities. Look, we all love baseball, man. We all want to watch baseball. I have loved watching baseball for the last week. I stay up all night until 2 a.m. watching West Coast games, and I love it. And it's exciting and thrilling. And like, I am really enjoying the drama of extra innings now, right? Like, all of these changes to the game that I have been like advocating for years, shorten the season. Like, yeah, let's get a runner on second and extra innings. Let's have the DH in both leagues. Like, I have both. Like, I have all the things that I wanted, and it's great. And I love watching the science experiment play out. But it feels like a science experiment in a bad way as well, with the amount of people who are getting sick. But as I alluded to earlier, just considering the climate in the United States and considering that MLB has now set a precedent and a standard that one outbreak is okay, that like, we're okay with one outbreak and we'll keep playing through one. What does it take then? When does the inertia stop? Like, at a certain point, like, there has to be a threshold that would be passed when you would say, okay, we're going to shut this down, or we're going to take like a week off for everybody. We're going to take a week or two break and just chill and let this settle and see where things are at and let some of these test results come back and like see how bad this really is. But the standard right now has been set that MLB will continue playing through an outbreak, through 20% of the league not being able to play games. So considering that, I don't know what it would take, Ben.
Well, already Major League Baseball is dealing with a ton of logistical issues. You know, you think from a scheduling standpoint, from a testing standpoint, how do you manage a season where one team plays 57 games and one plays 60 and the Marlins play 45 or whatever the number ends up being? I mean, there are tons of questions. Of course, more importantly, as you said, are the human consequences. I mean, that's the biggest effect of all of this, is the people who get infected with COVID-19 and potentially die from it. Obviously, there is a death rate here. People die from this virus. And so that's something that can't be overlooked when we're talking about what the consequences are of MLB returning to play. And, you know, localizing it a little bit to the Toronto Blue Jays, what a wild, wild few right. weeks, right?
Right, like, it's a Blue Jays podcast, right?
Yeah, and of course, they are very much within this whole, they're so connected to everything else right now. So it's all these teams, I think, are facing these challenges collectively, whether they want to or not. This brings them all in together. But for the Blue Jays, what a wild few weeks. I mean, you look at the uncertainty that they had over their home ballpark. They first thought they were going to play, as we record this on Friday, they thought today's game would be in Toronto. Then they thought it was going to be in Pittsburgh. Then they thought it was going to be in Baltimore. Now Buffalo, then Philadelphia. Then, oh, it's going to be a doubleheader on Saturday. And finally, now there are no games at all. TBD, we'll see if and when they play it at all. And that's just a day in the life for the Blue Jays. I mean, this isn't even the craziest thing to happen to them. They've been dealing with this sort of uncertainty all season long, and they've played pretty decently in the midst of this uncertainty. But it's crazy. Like, they're on this extended road trip. You know, it was supposed to be a 16-game road trip to open the season, which, by the way, is longer than any road trip that a team would take in a quote-unquote normal season by basically a full week. So they're facing this extended road trip. They haven't been home in a long time. None of these guys have had the chance to set up anything resembling a comfortable home in Buffalo. So when they arrive there, it still will sort of be like an extension of this long road trip. It's just a wild, wild start to the season. I mean, you widen the lens a little bit from between the lines for the Blue Jays, and they are just facing insane amounts of uncertainty.
They had, you know, players had families that were going to be meeting up with them in Philadelphia. Those plans are now changed. You know, Travis Shaw was supposed to meet up with the club in Philadelphia. He's now in limbo. Like, the club is going to hang out in Washington through the weekend and kind of stagger workouts with the Nationals at Nationals Park. The Blue Jays being a team, by the way, that, like, we don't talk about this enough, already had an outbreak in Dunedin before training camp began and had to shut down their spring training facility because a number of individuals at the park in Dunedin came down with COVID and, you know, it picked it up in the community, but then brought it into the facility. This is a club that right now in Buffalo is like replacing all of the lights in a stadium at Salem Field and building big structures, you know, beyond the outfield walls for training purposes and clubhouse purposes. They're building batting cages on the concourse. Like, there's a ton of work going on in Buffalo right now. Like, they've tapped into the same folks who helped like bring Field of Dreams up to like an MLB standard. Like, there is a lot going on. It's a huge operation, multi-million dollars. And I don't know, will the Blue Jays ever play there? We'll see. You know, the first game there is August 11th. That is, you know, 12 days away from where we are right now, Ben. And like, I am like hesitant to let this podcast segment go on 12 more minutes because what's going to happen next? Because like the news is just moving so fast and the Blue Jays have been so impacted by that. You're right. You know, I don't know. I don't have a definitive ranking of who has been the most like impacted by what's going on in MLB right now, but the Blue Jays are near the top with the amount of adversity they faced. And you do have to wonder how it's going to, you know, affect them towards the back half of this road trip. If anything, it might be a bit of a benefit that they get a few days off right now and that like everybody gets to kind of catch their breath and chill. I do, you know, you wonder about the like fatigue and the toll that a 16 game road trip within, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe 17 days, at most 18, what that would take just going city to city. And like you and I can like speak to this a little bit in that any time that we cover like a 7-game road trip with two cities in it, by the end of it, you were just gassed. Like the amount of travel and like, you know, being in uncomfortable situations and like not, you know, not sleeping and working all the time and the stress and the toll and the fatigue, like that wears on you, man. And we don't have to, you know, take the field and perform in front of 50,000 people, right? Like, and this year in front of 50,000 cardboard cutouts. Like we, you know, we don't have to be on, you know, TV. Well, maybe we do, but not to the extent the players are. Fair enough. Yeah. But that was a bad point. But not to the extent the players are, right? And we don't face the same criticism that a Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is facing right now for his performance at the plate, the same stress that he's probably feeling.
If I go 0-for-3 on my chat topics with Hazel, it doesn't ruin anyone's fantasy team.
No. I did wonder about, you know, just what type of shape this team is going to be at the end of the 16-game road trip. Now it's not going to be a 16-game road trip, but at some point, you assume the Blue Jays are going to have to make up these games, I guess. I don't know. Will MLB, they are just making up these rules on the fly, right? Like, competitive integrity is, like, out the window because they're just like, yeah, we'll just change the schedule, like, you know, just willy-nilly. Like, yeah, you know what? Doubleheader games are 7 innings now. Okay, like what, competitive integrity is gone now because the Blue Jays will likely have to play some doubleheaders to make up some of these games. So the Blue Jays are going to have a number of 7-inning games that they have played in which maybe they lose those games by one run. And maybe in a different world, if there's an 8th and 9th inning, like Teoscar Hernandez hits a 2-run bomb in the 8th or the 9th and the Blue Jays actually win that game. But they end up losing those games in 7 innings and they are competing with other teams in this wild card race, whether it is Cleveland or Boston or whoever, who may play all 9-inning games and may have the benefit of those, you know, 2 more innings in all of their games with which to overcome leads. So I don't know what's going to happen next, clearly. I think that much is certain, Ben. But I do know that like the fallout of this for the Blue Jays is not over because at some point they're going to have to try to make up some of these games.
For sure. For sure. And who knows what form that takes. You know, it's funny when you think back, like it's not that long ago that we recorded our last podcast. It's not that long ago that the Blue Jays opened their season, but consider some of the things that have changed since Major League Baseball began its season just last week. The Blue Jays did not have a home park. Now they have completed their search for a home park. They finally have a home park. Major League Baseball has changed its playoff structure since the season began. Major League Baseball has changed its in-game rules for extra innings, as you mentioned, since the season began. So all of this is happening on the fly. All of this is being made up basically to fit whatever set of circumstances arises on a given day. With that, you have all these postponements, you have all these cancellations. By the time people are listening to this, hopefully there are no more, but there might be more cancellations or more positive tests. It's just the league is making so much up on the fly, and it's astounding for a sport that is normally so slow to change, normally so averse to change. But everything this year is just, it's basically just like this improv game that they're playing, and the rules are shifting underneath everyone on a basically ongoing basis.
It is 2020, and why would it be any other way? That has been the theme of this year. It's just chaos and everybody making it up as they go along. And MLB is just right in the deep end of that right now. So who knows where things will stand by this weekend? Who knows where things will stand by next week? But over the back half of this podcast, you're going to hear where Ben and I believed things stood on Thursday. And we're going to talk Nate Pearson. We're going to talk Vlad. We're going to talk pitching. We're going to talk all things Blue Jays. And then next week, who knows what we're going to talk about. But I know we will talk to you then. So after this, some Blue Jays talk here on At The Letters. Let's shift our attention to the field, because we do actually have some real, actual, live, professional baseball to analyze here for the first time in a long time. That's pretty exciting. The Blue Jays are 3-3 to this point. As I mentioned, you know, they've been in every game, and, you know, Charlie Montoyo has been like banging that drum of like, we're competing. You know, we've been there with like some pretty good teams, the Tampa Bay Rays, who obviously are, you know, one of the best teams in the American League, and the Washington Nationals, who won a championship last year. Like, we've been right there. But like, I don't know, Ben, I'm on MLB.com right now, and I am like looking for the moral victories tab. Like, I want to organize the standings by lessons learned, and I'm just not seeing it, because it's just wins and losses. And the Blue Jays are 3-3 to this point. And like, sure, you could like very easily, you know, just kind of like shift the puzzle pieces and like make it look like a 6-0, right? Like, there are a couple things that could have broken for this team to make them 6-0, but they didn't. And they're 3-3. So how do we look at that? Do we think that the 3-3 is a true representation of how they've played? Or do we think that they actually deserve better than they've gotten to this point?
I think they deserve better in some ways. Man, like, their pitching has been so good. It's actually been, you know, night and day compared to last year, when it felt like we were watching a team of waiver wire pickups. And it's such a contrast when you go from the final game of the 2019 season, started by Clay Buchholz, who, you know, had a great career, pitched a no-hitter, but he was at the end of his rope in 2019. And then you go from that to opening day, Hyunjin Ryu, mixing and matching. He wasn't that pleased with the start, but he was, I thought, really good. Had a changeup at times that was devastating. Kept hitters off balance. You can see why he is so good at limiting hard contact. And from there, the rotation just kept going. They got really good results from Matt Shoemaker. Obviously, the Pearson debut, which we'll get to, was incredibly impressive. And even outings like Thomas Hatch and Anthony Kay. I mean, it was an incredibly impressive combination of starts from that starting rotation. The disappointing thing to me comes down to some leverage opportunities in the bullpen that went to Sam Gavilio and Shun Yamaguchi, and they did not deliver at all. And it seems to me like this team should be 4-2 now. Sure, like, yeah, they could be 6-0 if you try to get a little bit, you know, cute with it, but I think really they should be 4-2. And so to be 3-3 at this point, when every game counts, I think that is a little disappointing.
It's kind of funny to look at the starting staff and see that Hyunjin Ryu had the worst outing of anybody on that staff the first time through the rotation. like if you were ordering them, and his outing wasn't bad. Like I thought he was fine. Like he didn't have his fastball command. And I thought like, you know, maybe the endurance wasn't quite there just yet, but the changeup was good. Like the curveball was good. You know, he's getting swing and miss up with the fastball at times. Like, yeah, I thought he did a good job of getting through his innings. But if you just order those starts in terms of performance, like his was the worst. You know, Matt Shoemaker was fantastic. Nate Pearson was unhittable. You know, like Trent Thornton was really good. Gave up a lot of hard contact, but like only gave up a run in his four innings. You know, like he BABIP was his friend on that day, but like results wise, only one earned run over four innings. Thomas Hatch was a revelation. It looked great. He's, you know, had a phenomenal start and now is going to probably leave this rotation, but that's just because like it's kind of a crowded picture right now. And even the guys coming in and throwing bulk innings in relief, Ryan Brucki, Anthony Kay, even Jacob Wagesback, like the Blue Jays have to be really encouraged with the rotation depth that they're showing right now. Obvious caveat being it's only one trip through the rotation. Like anything can happen going forward. But through six games, I mean, you know, aside from Hyunjin Ryu being a little rusty, it's about as good as you could hope for.
It's night and day. It's really good. And I think that in a sense, you don't want to read too much into one turn through the rotation. But Nate Pearson showed us, I mean, if you're throwing 99 in the outside corner, like that's a repeatable, demonstrable, hard to find skill that just objectively makes major league pitchers good. So, you know, I don't think that we're reading too much into a BABIP assisted start or anything like that here. So they have the ingredients to continue being a good starting rotation. They have some depth behind those pieces. As an organization, as a team that's trying to compete in the short term, these are great signs. It is a big change. I'm not expecting Tanner Roark and Matt Shoemaker to keep pitching quite as well. I mean, I'm sure they're going to have some outings where they go five innings and allow four earned runs, and that's okay. I mean, if the offense comes around, they can still compete on days like that. So it's not to say that these guys are going to be as good as they have, but I think there's more in the tank from Ryu. Pearson looks incredible. And like you said, the depth from the Wagesbacks and the Kays and the Hatches means that if and when someone goes down, they are not in a situation where it's total scramble mode. We need to call up, you know, a left-handed knuckleballer like they did last year with Ryan Feuerbend.
Where is Edwin Jackson? Yeah, no, you're right. Like Tanner Roark's going to regress to his mean, obviously, but like Hyunjin Ryu is going to positively regress to his as well. And you would expect that he's going to be better than he's shown. Like my point with Ryu having probably the worst turn throughout this first like flip in the rotation is that like that's the last guy you worry about. That's the guy that you're like, no, he'll be fine. Like there's nothing wrong there. So it's certainly encouraging. Let's do the Nate Pearson discussion then, because we watched it last night and this like is just a dream debut.
Notice Pearson pitches from the stretch all the time. Another good breaking ball, and he strikes out the first batter he faces in the big leagues.
And a heck of a big league hitter in Trey Turner. He hit 298 last year, and he threw him a couple of very good sliders.
Like, you could not have drawn this outing up any better. I mean, it was right from the first batter of the game, Trey Turner. Nate Pearson, like, first pitch fastball for a strike. Second pitch misses with the fastball and then goes back to back sliders, like doubles up on the sliders, and they are both like electric and moving. And like Trey Turner, who's a really, really good hitter, like just cannot figure out what to do with it. And to me, that was the moment when Nate Pearson must have been like, oh, I have my good slider tonight. And his fastball, well, he was commanding it the way he wanted to. I know he wasn't that happy with it in the early going, but as you mentioned, he got to a point where he was able to dot his fastball 99 miles an hour, like down and away to Carter Kieboom, who had like the reaction of the night, like looking at that called third strike pitch. Like, what do you want me to do with that? I can't hit this. There is nothing that I can do with that pitch, but like at best, foul it off. So once Nate Pearson knew like that early that his slider was working the way it was and that his fastball was better than it was his last time out, I mean, I'm not surprised that from that point forward he made it look easy, because as you mentioned, you know, like a guy with four pitches, like a guy who has a pretty good curveball as well and a changeup that's a real weapon for him, but he didn't even need those last two pitches until like the fourth inning to Eric Thames when he threw them the first time. You know, he threw 40 plus pitches, just fastball sliders, and had a lot of success. So that was only half of his repertoire that he used to get there. I'm not sure it's always going to be that easy for Nate Pearson every time out. We saw in Boston, there's times he takes the mound and his mechanics aren't quite there. He's kind of battling with something and is struggling a bit. But the fact that his repertoire is as deep as it is, you've got to assume on most nights he's going to have at least two pitches working for him. If he even only had the fastball working for him, as you mentioned, that's still a dominant big league weapon. So if he's got two pitches working for him on a given night, I mean, he's going to be able to have a really good outing more often than not.
Right. You look at the box score and five innings shutout against the Nationals, who won the World Series last year. So that's good. You know from that that the game went well. But then if you look beyond the results to the ingredients that led Pearson there, then it almost becomes more impressive because Pearson's fastball averaged 96. He was locating it. He was up to 99. That is elite. That's the level of Zach Wheeler and Jacob DeGrom and Noah Syndergaard and Luis Castillo. That is an elite major league fastball with command. Then you look at the slider. Like you said, he was throwing it from the first batter of the game until the last batter of the game, down in the zone, hitting Jansen's glove, getting swing and miss. That is the swing and miss plus breaking pitch that an ace needs. And then even beyond that, to show the changeup and the curveball as pitches that he can locate in the zone for strikes. We saw him flip in a first pitch curveball to Eric Thames. We saw him mix in the changeup periodically as the innings progressed. And to have those weapons at his disposal will keep hitters off balance, not only the first time they face Pearson, but when he faces teams like the Yankees and Red Sox and Rays over and over, which of course he'll do this season and then throughout his career. So I don't think it's hyperbole to say that this debut could not have gone better. It was a perfect debut. I think that that doesn't guarantee Pearson anything. It doesn't guarantee the Blue Jays anything. He still has to work for every result that comes from here. The Blue Jays can't take for granted this performance, and we don't know how long it's going to last. But on Wednesday, that major league debut was as good as the Blue Jays could have hoped for.
Yeah, you mentioned those traits that put him in the same category as some of the elite arms in this game. One that I would add to that is the fact that his fastball got firmer as the game went on. His velocity increased as he got deeper into his outing, which like speaks to how he is managing his gas tank and how efficient he is with his energy. That's like, that is an elite trait. Like that is something that is very hard to learn, and total credit to Nate Pearson for the amount of work that he's put into to be able to pitch like that. Like that is what you were looking for when you're looking for somebody who can front up pitching staff and you're looking for somebody who can be a starting pitcher who can log 200 inning seasons like your Justin Verlanders of this world, you know, like your Zach Greinke's. Obviously he doesn't have the same velocity as a Pearson, you know, like a Garrett Cole. Like these are the traits that these guys have. So like that is special to see. And I, you know, you mentioned the Thames plate appearance as well. Like that is probably the one place I could criticize Nate Pearson in this outing. Like it's the one thing I can look at. He goes first pitch curveball, a curve which he hadn't thrown all night, and it's like perfectly located on like the outside black, like outside edge curveball, first pitch, amazing. And then he misses badly at the changeup. Now he's 1-1. And I think that throughout his minor league career in situations like this, Nate Pearson's been able to go to his fastball and just blow it by a hitter and get a swing and miss or get a foul ball because they can't catch up to his heater. But this is the majors. And Eric Thames is a major league hitter. And he was sitting fastball and he was timed up with it. And he was able to punish Nate Pearson and put that pitch into right field for a double. I think in that spot, Nate Pearson, Danny Jansen should have gone to a slider, you know, and Nate Pearson like said as much after the game when we asked him about it. And he was like, yeah, you know, I think I would have gone to a different pitch there, you know, in the future. And that's part of the learning process here for Nate Pearson. Like that's part of the experience here that, you know, that's why it's so crucial that he's pitching the big leagues this year and getting those learning experiences under his belt and understanding big league hitters and how to attack them. And that in, you know, 1-1 counts like that, you can't just groove a fastball. You know, you still have to be like fine with a hard, sharp slider. Like you still have to use the right tool for the situation. So that pitch selection, I think, was honestly the only thing I can look at from this start as a negative for Nate Pearson, like other than the fact that he was on a pitch count. Because like if he wasn't on a pitch count, this could have been a 7-8 inning scoreless start pretty easily.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree. And Pearson could have located that fastball better. But I also think, you know, it's kind of funny when we're talking about this, we're breaking it down. We're trying to, you know, look at the whole start, both the positives and the negatives. And the quote unquote negative that we're identifying is a 96 mile an hour fastball that a rookie threw over the plate in the strike zone in his major league debut. Like, that's the quote unquote tough spot. And that just tells you how good his debut was.
Yeah, he's going to be great on a curve because he's that good. We're going to expect, you know, more of him going forward. But like, I have, you know, just knowing what I know about Nate Pearson and like you as well, and the reporting we've done on this guy, like, it's hard to find somebody who you would have more confidence in actually putting in the work necessary and doing what he needs to do to like get the most out of his career. Like, I think that's why the Blue Jays are so encouraged by him, is because this guy just nails like everything about his preparation and his recovery and what he does between starts. Like, he's so invested in himself and in his own career and in like being as successful as he can as a big leaguer, you know, and which is really like another one of those kind of elite traits and elite skills, is that he puts that work in. Unfortunately for him, the bullpen blew it late in the game. You mentioned it. Sam Gavilio in leverage, Shun Yamaguchi in leverage didn't go so well. And this is the second time now in the first six games that Charlie Montoyo has essentially like run out of leverage arms and has had to go to those guys in those spots. I don't necessarily blame Charlie Montoyo for using Gavilio and Yamaguchi in those spots, because that's all that he had. To me, the fact that the Blue Jays have like blown a couple leads here with those guys in big spots, that's roster construction. I'm not necessarily, you can put that all on the manager.
I agree. You know, I look back at it after the game because I wanted to be sure that there wasn't another path. And even in this era of expanded bullpens and 30-man rosters, the Blue Jays had already used a lot of their key relievers earlier in the game before it got to extra innings. And guys like Anthony Kay and Thomas Hatch, well, officially in the bullpen, had pitched just a few days earlier. So they were on pretty short rest. In that situation, you've got Yamaguchi, you sign him to a two-year deal, you have to see what you have there. And so I understand going to him. And same with Gavilio on the weekend. That was a day where they had Bass and Romano and Giles all sidelined. So what are you going to do? Dolis, too, was out of the picture that day. So what are you going to do? You have to get creative. And Gavilio didn't deliver. So I think at this point, the onus actually shifts away from Montoyo. I mean, he has to do everything he can to avoid using Gavilio in leverage, because let's be honest here, the stuff is not there. Gavilio's fastball is averaging under 88 miles per hour. His swinging strike rate has declined in the early going from 12% last year to 2% this year. So he is not fooling anybody. He is not throwing hard. If this is what you're giving Charlie Montoyo, it's hard to expect really a different result. So I think at a certain point, it's time to DFA Gavilio. It's time to bring somebody else onto the staff.
That's strong, Ben. I don't know that I would be... I'm pretty sure the Blue Jays are not going to do that. I mean, Charlie Montoyo,
why,
we know...
Why not, though? Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you think about that?
I would think about it, but I think the Blue Jays won't do it, because Sam Gavilio has given a lot to this organization over the last couple of years. And like, I'm fine. I'm here for the debate that you'll likely have with me over like that being the past and this being the present, and, you know, not letting what a guy has done for you in the past like inflect your decision making now. I'll argue against myself there, certainly. But I don't think the Blue Jays are gonna do that. I think they do have, you know, a certain amount of respect for what Sam Gavilio has given this organization over a couple lean years. Like, that's why, you know, if you ask like Pete Walker, Charlie Montoyo, even like a bunch of Blue Jays pitchers last year, like who the MVP of their pitching staff was, they would say Sam Gavilio. It wasn't because he, you know, like struck out Mike Trout in a high leverage situation. It's because he answered the bell. You know, it's because like whenever he was called upon, I mean, he saved that bullpen a lot of days and logged big innings and never complained. And, you know, I don't think that qualifies him for high leverage spots now, but he has been all that the Blue Jays have had. Obviously, it's underwhelming velocity and it's underwhelming stuff. I think he can get big leaguers out. I just think that he should be doing it in a different role than he is right now. To me, the DFA right now would be a little too extreme.
All right, how about this then? How about he has some shoulder soreness or back tightness and he goes on the IL? Because, you know, like, I just, wouldn't this bullpen be better with Yency Diaz in it? I'm looking at the Blue Jays 40-man roster now, and a lot of the pitchers on that 40-man roster are already with the major league team. But maybe it's time to have Brian Moran come back from the taxi squad where he was recently placed. Like, I don't think If you're looking for high leverage outs, Gavilio is clearly not the guy. If you're looking for bulk outs, well, now you have Waguespack and you have Kay and you have Hatch and you have Yamaguchi. So, you know, what's the role here? What's his purpose? And if you can't answer that question, then maybe it's time to have somebody else on the staff.
To me, that's the problem, is that the Blue Jays have too many bulk guys in this bullpen. Like Baraki, Kay, Hatch, Waguespack. You can throw Gavilio and Yamaguchi into that vein as well. Like, it's too many. You don't need that many with this rotation. Like, I understand wanting to have that insurance through the first week of the season, but I think that Hyunjin Ryu, Matt Shoemaker, you know, Nate Pearson, I think that these guys are like ready to go deep into outings. I don't think that you need that many layers of like bulk insurance. But also, Julian Merriweather has a side issue and he's not here right now and he's hurt. Patrick Murphy, I don't know where he is. He has been missing from Blue Jays camp. Team's not talking about him. Like, it's one of those kind of undisclosed deals. There's no benefit to anybody for us to speculate. I don't know where he is. All I know is that the Blue Jays could really use an arm like his, you know, pitching late innings out of this bullpen. Like, I think he could be ready to take a similar step to what Jordan Romano took this year. We just don't know what his status is. Sean Reed Foley, club's still working on him as a starter, right? They won't convert him to a reliever, even though it seems like his stuff would play a lot better there. That would be a guy that maybe you could use as a one inning max effort reliever right now. Still working on him as a starter. TJ Zoik, stretched out. Brian Moran, I do not think is going to be demonstrably better than Sam Gavilio. I've already run out of guys. Like, Jency Diaz isn't even on the 60-man player pool. So Elvis Luciano's on the injured list. I mean, who are you grabbing right now?
All right, let me walk back my DFA suggestion, okay? This is a free-flowing discussion here on At the Letters. We are not arriving here with preconceived notions. This is evolving on the fly, and I think you've made some good points there, Arden. So from an organizational depth perspective, you're not going to DFA Gavilio. So what you do is you put him on the fake IL, you come up with an injury for him, and he is off the roster, and he is going to just exist in parallel to this team, but not actually on the roster. And what you're going to do is you're going to find room for Justin Miller or Jake Petrichka or Ty Tice, Joey Murray. I don't know who it is. You're going to find one of those guys that impressed you in summer camp, and you're going to find a room for him on the roster. I think that's time to do this because Gavilio is not, and maybe you give him one or two more outings, but you know, we are getting close to the point in a short season where every game matters that you don't need Gavilio and you don't want him in leverage and you do have other alternatives.
Yeah, I think that Wilmer Font might be the internal candidate right now to step into some more leverage. They didn't want him going on back-to-back days, I suppose, in the Pearson start, because otherwise, I don't know why he wouldn't have been there. And obviously, he missed summer camp with one of these undisclosed injuries, and he's just kind of, you know, building back up and getting back up to speed. But I think that's the guy who could step in there. I mean, otherwise, when I look at this player pool, and especially when you look at the 40-man roster, which, like, it's a little uncertain what's going on there. Like, if you count them up, there are 43 players right now on the 40-man roster. And we know that if you're on the COVID-19 related injured list, that you don't count towards the 40-man. So, you know, when you see a guy on the roster resource page with, you know, undisclosed next to his name on the IL, you can make some assumptions there as to, you know, whether or not that individual is on the COVID-19 related injured list. We know Breivik Valera is on the restricted list, so that opens something up as well. But like, if the Blue Jays wanted to add like a Ty Tice right now, or Justin Miller, you mentioned Jake Petrichka, you know, a Travis Bergen, they would have to add one of those individuals to the 40 man, and somebody would have to go from it. And like, sure, you can, you know, Brian Moran, sure, you can find guys, right? That look, Anthony Alford's time might be ticking. They're not using him at all. Roster sizes are going to decrease soon. He's out of options. Derek Fisher is playing over him. Derek Fisher is playing well. You know, you can find individuals that you can move off this 40-man roster, but I still think it's like a difficult step for clubs to take because they just like to preserve their flexibility and they don't like to make those moves, particularly when it comes down to the 40-man, unless they absolutely necessarily have to. And I'm just not sure that you know, Blue Jays management is like riding the emotional roller coaster of some of these tight losses as much as fans are right now.
I hear that, and I think you're right. I think that at the same time, it is not emotional to say that Sam Gavilio is throwing 87 miles an hour. It's not it's not emotional to
is
say
that just
he can't,
factual. Yeah.
Exactly. It's not emotional to say that he can't get a swing and miss. It's not emotional to say that he's been ineffective. It's not emotional to say that when you're looking ahead at Sam Gavilio, when projecting forward what you expect from a guy who's already 30 years old, you're not expecting some sort of big breakout. So I agree with your points there, and 40-man roster management absolutely will come into this. The unfortunate thing here for the Blue Jays, Arden, is they actually might have somebody, and I say might, we don't know what's happening with Ken Giles, but they might have a spot opening up if Giles's absence is going to be longer than anticipated.
Let's talk about Giles in a second, but I want to get your thought on this quickly. With guys like Thomas Hatch, Anthony Kay, Ryan Barucki, who the club has kept stretched out as rotation depth, do you consider turning any of those guys for this season and this season only into a high leverage, one inning, maybe four outs, five outs reliever? Or do you need to keep those guys stretched out in case two thirds of your rotation gets COVID, or in case Matt Shoemaker suffers an injury and Hyunjin Ryu does as well? Like, how do you walk that line of keeping enough rotation depth versus what has to be tantalizing of seeing these arms throwing in the mid-90s and getting big league hitters out and thinking, maybe we could use them to fill the gap that we have right now in high leverage innings?
I would split the difference a little bit. You're not shortening these guys up to the point that they're 15 pitch pitchers. You know, you want them capable of going 45 to 55 pitches. So you want them ready to go three innings if they need to, but I don't think you need to keep them stretched out for five or six. I think you do need to play to win now. And right now, the Blue Jays need Thomas Hatch in a shorter role. They don't need him starting games at this moment. Same with Anthony Kay. So I think you tell those guys, be prepared to go two, three innings. You're not going to totally eliminate that possibility, but at the same time, when you're out there for those two innings, air it out. Don't try to prepare for the fifth inning of work, because it's not going to be you out there three, four, five innings from now. So I think, you know, to some extent you preserve a little bit of depth, but basically guys like Hatch and Kay should be ready to contribute in those shorter bursts.
For me, it's Barucki. That's the guy who I would do it with, because like his career has already been so star-crossed and messed up, like with the injuries and everything. And there's like so much missed potential there. Obviously, if this guy could just stay healthy, you know, like he could be 2018 Ryan Barucki, and he could be a really reliable innings eater in your rotation. But I think the Ryan Barucki that we saw the other day in his 2020 debut is a different Ryan Barucki than 2018 Ryan Barucki. Like, this is 94, 95 miles an hour Ryan Barucki. This is a guy with like a tight cutter now that he's throwing instead of his slider. This is a guy who's got weapons against lefties and righties, obviously still has the changeup, which is his best pitch, but like he's barely been using it lately because he hasn't needed it. Like, he has been not the same premium velocity, but he's been kind of like Andrew Miller-esque in the way that he has looked. And obviously it's only one start at the big league level and then a handful that we saw in intra squads and, you know, live BPs. But to me, that's the guy who you just take in this season and you say, like, look, we don't even really want to push you that far anyway, because we already had to shut you down during spring training because something grabbed in your elbow. You're just a one inning, four or five out high leverage reliever now, and you come in and you air it out and you're going to help us out in our bullpen, and maybe we can revisit starting in 2021, you know, down the road, and maybe get you back to, you know, where you want your career to be. But I think if there's one guy who can fill that need for this club right now, Barucki's the guy.
Well, you know what, it is a need when you look at left-handed relief. You know, we're talking about Brian Moran, we've talked about Thomas Pannone, Tim Meza, of course, sidelined with Tommy John, so he's not available. That would fill a gap for this team, and it would definitely give Montoyo a weapon that he could use against teams' runs of left-handed hitters in the middle of their orders.
And you got Chase Anderson coming back as well. So, you know, you got some starting depth, you know, coming back into the fold soon too. So, you know, I think the Ryan Barucki could be shifted there. What do you make of Shun Yamaguchi? Like, this guy is the biggest enigma to me right now, because you look at the stats in Japan. Like, Ben, last year in Japan, this guy threw 181 innings and had a 2.78 ERA. He had a 9.6 K per nine last season in Japan, and now he's come to the big leagues and cannot get swing and miss. And it's like, how did this guy strike out 9.5 batters every nine? It just, like, I obviously, you know, didn't watch his 181 innings last year in Japan, but I have to assume that there has been some sort of a decrease in the effectiveness of the stuff, or he is just going through some sort of a really, really tough transition to the big league ball or big league mounds or big league hitters and their approaches. What do you do with him? Like, how do you get Shun Yamaguchi right? Because it's a 2-year deal that he's on and he's making decent money.
Yeah, I think the 2-year deal tells you, I mean, there's obviously some buy-in from the organization on Yamaguchi. They're not going to give up on him quickly, nor should they. I think you're looking at a guy whose stuff has been, you know, in comparison to Gavilio, it's been better, right? He's averaging 91 with his fastball. He's getting swinging strikes on 9% of the pitches he throws. So that's a little below the league average, but it's not way below. So with him, I think you move him to lower leverage, which, you know, last night, it's not like he was their first choice in high leverage anyways. So I think you continue using him if you're down by 4, if you're up by 5. That's the role for Yamaguchi, and you hope that things improve for him.
Ken Giles, that was a very strange situation that we saw play out in Tampa Bay as Ken Giles entered to try to save a game. And it was just like with every pitch that he threw, I was getting more and more uncomfortable watching it on TV. To me, from where I sit, like he did not look right from basically like the Adames walk on. Like you remember how that inning played out? Like he got a couple quick outs, Kiermaier and Margot got the outs, then Joey Wendell got him for a double, and then all of a sudden, like velocity's down to like 93-94, he's missing the strike zone by a lot, he's grimacing after his pitches, he's taking these long walks off the mound, and he kind of stayed in, man, through the walk to Adames, and then the walk to Setsugo, and then the walk to G-Man Choi. Like just with every pitch, I was thinking, like, I was looking at it like a fighter who is like just getting his ass kicked in a fight, and he's going back to his corner, and his corner needs to throw in the towel, and they just aren't doing it, and they just keep sending him back out there to take more punishment. With every pitch, I just kept being like, man, how are they not getting this guy out of the game? When Pete Walker went to talk to him, I was like, how? This hot? Surely this is the end. Like, surely this is it. It's obvious to me watching on TV that this guy is like not right and like putting himself at danger by continuing to pitch through this. And like, look, Charlie Montoyo has forgotten more about managing than I'll ever know in my life. So I defer to him and to those guys and their decision-making at that time. But like for me, just as a casual observer watching on TV, like there were points that inning where I was like, I don't know if I can keep watching this. Like, I don't know how this is going to continue.
Yeah, I think if there's something you want to criticize about the pitching usage, then that might be where you land, right? It's just, hey, this could have been a spot to take him out earlier. Certainly with the benefit of hindsight, we can say that it would have been prudent to take him out earlier. You know, at the time, you maybe say you want to let him work his way through it, or maybe he's telling you that he's feeling okay. Regardless, where we are now is an uncertain spot for the Blue Jays, a little bit of a scary spot for the Blue Jays, certainly for Giles, who's heading into his free agent year. It's a very uncertain and scary spot. And I think, you know, the presence of Jordan Romano, the emergence of Jordan Romano, maybe eases some of this, but there's no replacing a guy like Giles. He is a very, very effective late inning reliever. And so the Blue Jays have to hope that this forearm strain proves to be just that, and the Giles can return within a couple of weeks.
Yeah, if by working through it, you mean like working through his ulnar collateral ligament, like you mean like working through completely tearing that thing, like clearly something is not right in that elbow, right? Like, you know, whenever, you know, a club says, oh, he's dealing with like a forearm strain, like that is just code for he's got elbow issues, right? Like the forearm, you know, it's connected to the elbow, like the whole deal. Like there's clearly something going on with that elbow. He missed time with it last season. I don't think that it's just going to be 2 weeks, Ben. Like we know it's going to be 10 days. But I mean, just the fact that he's gone for an MRI, he's going for second opinions, you know, the club hasn't released any information about, you know, what the results have been on those tests and those assessments. Like, I have to think that this is going to be more than 2 weeks.
Well, it's looking like that with each day that passes, right? It's not as though this is a situation with a lot of clarity for the Blue Jays, but I think it's easier to imagine that this would be a month plus than it is to imagine that he would be back in 10 days from now, that's for sure.
So what does this mean for how, like, not only the future of Ken Giles with the Blue Jays, but like his future, like with free agency and the Blue Jays' future with Ken Giles? Like, a trade has to be off the table now, I guess. Do the Blue Jays look at extending a guy whose elbow keeps giving him problems, but a guy who also, like, when he's been healthy and able to pitch, has been like as lights out as any closer in baseball over the last, you know, year and a half? I mean, it's such an interesting dilemma for the club. One, I'm sure like they wish they didn't have to face, but like I do wonder like how they do approach this, because this guy when he's on is lights out, but like how do you know whether you can trust him? How do you know whether you can use him on back-to-back days? Like we didn't see him used on back-to-backs at all over the second half of last season after like the Canada Day 3 days in a row thing. If you're the Blue Jays, like how do you approach this?
You wait. I think you wait and see. And that's what you have to do. I agree. A trade is very, very hard to imagine right now, as is an extension. The next hurdle is figuring out what that health is. And until Giles can get back on a mound and show that he is capable of being that effective, high leverage, late inning reliever, then no one's going to trade for him. No one's going to extend him. And so it puts a lot of pressure on Giles. It's certainly far less than ideal for the Blue Jays. But at this point, it just requires patience. It creates opportunity for guys like Romano and Bass, who are really stepping up and have both looked to be really good and potentially even capable of handling that absence. But in the meantime, it's a lot of uncertainty and patience required from Giles and to a lesser extent from the team itself.
And the Blue Jays have already tried to trade him once. We must remember, like at the deadline last year, had a deal with the New York Yankees that fell through at the last minute. So like the Blue Jays clearly want to turn, you know, Ken Giles into futures. Like they've already tried to do that. They've tried to, we all hate using this terminology, but like, you know, get some, you know, return for the asset. And that's obviously going to be pretty impossible to do between now and the end of August when the trade deadline is, like unless he makes a miraculous recovery and is back on a mound looking like himself again. But already there is some question as to the return the Blue Jays could get in a shortened season when the acquiring team would only be getting him for a month, which could be, you know, under best circumstances, like 12 innings, 15 innings tops. But with a guy like Ken Giles who has elbow issues and who hasn't been able to pitch on back-to-back days, you have to assume that's going to be even less. So like Blue Jays fans like love to harp on the return for Josh Donaldson and, you know, like Julian Merriweather not having appeared in the major leagues since that trade was made and, you know, the poor asset management that occurred there. I mean, Ken Giles is setting up right now to be even worse.
That's right. And the trickle-down effect is immediately apparent, because we wouldn't be talking about Gavilio and leverage. We might not be talking about Yamaguchi and leverage if Giles was healthy, because at that point, everyone slots down. You've got Dolis and Bass and Romano, and those guys can handle the middle innings, and everyone else just gets to take on a little bit of a lesser role. So these things are all connected, of course. And if Giles can come back, then right away, these discussions become a little bit easier, and maybe you don't have people like me suggesting that Sam Gavilio should be DFA'd.
I don't know if you can DFA anybody from this bullpen right now. Like, it is on such a razor's edge, you know, like in terms of who Charlie Montoya could trust and leverage without Giles. Like, if Jordan Romano hadn't, and we're not talking about him enough, we should talk about him more, but like, if he hadn't developed into what he has, what a gift for this club right now. Like, if that hadn't happened, you would be looking at Anthony Bass and Rafael Dolis as your leverage arms right now. And like Dolis has been pretty hit or miss. Like the stuff's electric, the stuff's great, but he's got to be more consistent with it. He's got to get it into the strike zone. Anthony Bass, like we're all scratching our heads as to, you know, how Seattle put this guy on waivers at the end of last season. When you look at the fastball slider combo, the ground balls he gets, he throws a cool little splitter to lefties just to give him a way to attack the other side of the platoon and like have a pitch that kind of moves the other direction from his slider. Like I think that's a really useful weapon his repertoire, and you have to be encouraged by his composure on the mound and like how closer-ish he looks out there. But like, yeah, like, you know, Jordan Romano developing the way he has been such a huge benefit for this club, because they are just on the razor's edge with high leverage in this bullpen.
That's right. And this is a guy who last year was rule fived. He was trying to stretch out as a starting pitcher. Rangers took a look at him. Blue Jays got him back, and they have to be thrilled about that. And again, like we talked about it with Pearson, but the velocity, right? You have the velocity going up to 98 miles an hour. That will buy you some room for error. Sometimes when you throw it over the middle, Eric Thames might hit it for a double. But sometimes if you're throwing 98, they're just going to miss it. And that's the kind of margin for error that Romano has with this newfound velocity.
Yeah, Romano did a lot of work over the offseason at Kinetic Pro down in Tampa, which is where Nate Pearson also trains, you know, through with Motus sleeves, like worked with Rapsodo, like really tracked his pitches and tracked his workloads in ways that he hasn't before, and used those tools to get better and to make himself, you know, into the like really well-developed high leverage arm that he suddenly is now in the major leagues, like materializing with these 98 mile an hour fastballs and wipe out sliders. Like he made his stuff that much better, you know. Again, like similar to Pearson, a guy who really committed to it and used the tools and resources available to him and really elevated his career and put himself in a position to be like a really good big leaguer for years to come. Speaking of that, let's finish on Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
1-1 from both, and a breaking ball hit high in the air left center field. The ball is out. It's a home run for Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
Speaking of people who we expect to be really good big leaguers for years to come, when I look at Vladimir Guerrero Jr. at the plate this season, I am looking for several things. I am looking for him to be hitting the ball in the air and avoiding ground balls. I am looking for him to be judging the strike zone the way that we know that he can and laying off of bad pitches. And I am looking for him to not be getting frustrated when calls don't go his way and to not then, like, you know, chase basically, and to not then get out of his approach. I haven't seen any of those things yet, Ben. I have seen a carryover from 2019. I have seen more and more ground balls. I have seen odd plate appearances where he's chasing pitches that you know he shouldn't. And I've seen him frustrated at the plate. These are things that, you know, more so than the body type for me and the conditioning and more so than the defense, like those are the things that I thought Vladimir Guerrero Jr. really needed to show improvement on this season. It's still early. There's still time for him to turn that around. But to this point, I have not seen those improvements, and I am just kind of puzzled as to what is going on with him offensively right now.
I'm with you on that. I think you make a lot of good points there, and it's funny. I mean, you kind of listed them there, but there are a lot of things going on here with Vlad Jr. in the early going. We've seen him adjust to a new position, of course, one with less defensive upside, if you want to call it that, one that's designed to help him at the plate. And we've seen him show up in conditioning that Charlie Montoyo has said probably could potentially be improved. So it's hard to tell. We're all very far from Vladimir Guerrero Jr. He's obviously a very muscular guy, but maybe the mobility would be better if he was a little lighter on his feet as well. There's a give and take there. So you've got the conditioning, you've got the position, and then the offense has not really been there. And I think, you know, again, it's not just a question of the results, which aside from the home run have not been great, but you've also got the way he's getting there. And again, it is a lot of ground balls. It's hard ground balls, but Vlad Guerrero Jr. is not here in the major leagues to hit hard ground balls. He is here in the major leagues to hit line drives and fly balls and home runs. And we're not seeing a ton of that. So again, it's early. It is only 6 games into the season as we record this. There's a lot of time for him to make those adjustments. And it must be said again that he is 21 years old, an age at which a lot of players are still just in college or being drafted and still finding themselves as professionals or even as amateurs. Vlad is way ahead of the curve according to his age. And certainly hitters like Christian Yelich have hit a lot of ground balls before becoming elite power hitters. So this isn't damning for Vlad, but it's also not encouraging. And for a guy who last year was considered this new face of the franchise, it's certainly a different discussion that we're having now in the early part of the 2020 season.
Yeah, the thing to me, Ben, is like he just does not look comfortable or confident in the box. And when we watched him come up through the minors, like at Lansing, at Dunedin, New Hampshire, like this was a guy who had so much poise and confidence in the box. Like I remember him taking pitches and like watching them through the strike zone and doing almost like some Juan Soto type of stuff, right? Like, you know, and like kind of like stomping his foot a little bit and like doing little like shimmies and shaking his hips and, you know, shaking his head when you know, he knows a pitch is going to miss and it does. And I'm just not seeing that confidence right now. And I'm not seeing him pick up pitches the way that he has in the minors. So I do wonder if it's like a little bit of an approach thing. It's a little bit of like just thinking along with hitters and maybe just like, you know, just needing to maybe quiet some of the thoughts that he's taken to the plate and some of the things that he's trying to guard against and just have like a more simplified approach and a real plan at the plate. Because remember, this is a guy who walked more than he struck out in the minors. And I, you know, part of that sure is probably minor league pitchers like being scared of his bat, but part of that is also him understanding what pitchers are trying to do to him and him like understanding what he's going to get, what a pitcher's repertoire is, having watched video on him, understanding what he throws and when. So I do kind of wonder if like some of that preparation work and just some of that poise in the box is, you know, is what he's missing.
Well, last year, the Blue Jays said that it was more pitch selection than anything else. And you look at the swing, we saw it in the home run derby. We see it when Vlad's at his best. If he is swinging at the pitches that he needs to swing at, then he's going to crush them. He's got incredible bat speed. He's a really, really strong guy. So he is going to hit them a long way. A lot of this can come down to pitch selection. And so maybe that's the saving grace here, is that if he can improve that, then we are looking at someone who can still tap into power that any hitter in the major leagues would be jealous of.
We shall see. That's Ben Nicholson-Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. I want to thank our producer, Christian Ryan, at Christian Ryan NS on Twitter. Lots to talk about this week, and I'm sure there will be lots to talk about again next week when we talk to you on At the Letters.